Dr. Olus Rhea, 18.
Now, talking about relationship of the settlers, where we stayed, our allotments were distant from one another normally. So it wasn't easy for us to go from one end to the other. You know, first of all, the access was not easy. Secondly, we didn't have the stamina to do that. And those of us who stayed, say, along the common pathway, who were, had lots along the common pathway, by and large, developed a camaraderie. We got friendly. I know that there were, and when we got to our own huts, we didn't wander, except for a specific purpose, except for the purpose of buying something, or hoping to sell something. You know, but for no other reason, or going to the hospital for treatment of something. But we stayed within the confines of our lots otherwise. But we got, of course, friendly with those staying around us. There was Mr. and Mrs. Hurty Ward, and there was the brother Ward, who was one of the administrators. I can't remember his first name, I'm sorry. There was a Russian, white Russian, called Sokolov, and his, who we thought was his wife, Vera, but actually was his companion. Also Russian. She belonged to a Russian circus. She was a performer in a Russian circus. And she was caught in Singapore and then decided to go to Bahau with Sokolov. Then there was this boy called Ryan, Tony Ryan, who was an artist, and his aunt. Now, Tony was a magnificent artist. He did a lot of pencil sketches, line drawings of scenery in Bahau, portraits, all of which are lost, sadly. And Ryan himself, unfortunately, after the war, got mentally ill. And the last I saw of him was in Woodbridge Hospital, where I used to go to provide dental treatment to the inmates when I was a lecturer at the university. And I saw him there completely schizophrenic, not knowing where he was, who he was. And so there's no chance of my ever trying to ask him to sketch something of Bahau through memory. If he was still, he'd be sane, that would be a wonderful source of getting illustrations of Bahau. He lived with his aunt. He was our immediate neighbor. Then across the way, there was a man called Cyril Shelkus and his family. Cyril was a pianist, and this is how we got together, and we got hold of another two chaps and formed our jazz band. And this is how we sort of, you know, entertained ourselves. And so there were these neighborly, there was this neighborhood friendship. We did, of course, meet and other people living elsewhere. And friendly with them. I used to go and visit, my father-in-law and his wife were living right on the other side. And at times I used to go and see him. And a few others, but generally we got along well with everybody else. No squabbles. But I think there was a little bit of political differences of opinion, which led to the change of the administration. Things like that did happen. But nothing serious ever took place there. We never did have much contact with the people living in Mukim 5 because access was difficult. They were quite separate from us. Geographically, a different place, 3 miles through jungle path to reach Mukim 5.
And just now you also mentioned about first generation of Eurasians were given red flower.
Red badge.
Yes, red badge. I was wondering why there was such an arrangement between, first generation Eurasians, and you considered by the Japanese as second generation, though you were.
Well, those who were pure English or, French or any European, other than the those belonging to any one of the nations forming the Allied group of nations, were the enemies of the Japanese. So they were interned. If they were married to local people, the wives were also interned. But their offsprings were not, funnily, because they were considered to be Singaporeans or Shona, citizens of Singapore. But because they were so close to their parents who were enemies of the Japanese, they were sort of they were grouped together as a suspicious lot of people, and they were had to they were let out on parole, as it were, and they had to signify the fact that they were on parole by wearing these red badges. But they did allow those who wished to go to Bahau to go to Bahau. But when nearer the end of the war, they were all sent back to Singapore to be interned in Siam Road.
So, in your parents' case, it was one of his parents.
You know, that was
European.
Funny. It's very funny, as far as my father was concerned, it was very funny. Because my father's father was German. He was Danish. By nationality, he was Danish, but ethnically German. Yet he was given a red star. I cannot understand that. And because he has had a red star, my mother had a red star. My mother's grandfather was English, not father.
No, that was many generations.
Yes. And I don't know how they worked, but that there you are.
But then you were left alone.
We were left alone.
Yes. Without wearing any
badge. No. We were considered to be citizens of Shonan-do, and therefore we were people of the country. But it was quite anomalous that my parents should have been given these red badges and treated that way. Especially in view of the fact that his father was Danish. And as far as I know, Danes didn't go into the war. How come we had the Danes who were in our camp? They were there all the time, without the red flag, without the red badge.
In the Dr. Pagler's family's case, none of them were wearing red badge?
Not that I know of. Not that I know of. But this is I don't know what the situation was. How they figured it out, I really don't know. And my brother-in-law was also wearing a red badge. His father and his mother were both Ceylon burghers. But he was one of the white, he was one of the white Eurasians who passed off as a European. He was a member of the Singapore Cricket Club. He was a very good sportsman. He was a champion tennis player, Singapore's champion tennis player. So they accepted him, overlooked the fact that he was not pure European, you know. Well, unfortunately, three weeks ago, he passed away at the age of 80-something.
And you mentioned your parents were taken away later on from Bahau.
Yes.
And what was your reaction to them being taken
away? Of course, I was very alarmed. I was quite distressed. And, I was very fond of my mother. I loved her very much. My father, I was always scared of. I could never treat him as. He never treated us as friends, as I treat my children as friends. And my children would come to me any time and tell me anything they want. But not my dad. I think it's because of his German upbringing. You know, his father. But, of course, in Bahau, there was a difference in relationship. There was a softening because of conditions. And of course, I was very upset. But as it turned out, by going to Siam Road, they're going from a very difficult place, a bad location, to what turned out to be a much better location, much better conditions of living. People who were in Siam Road will admit that. My good friend Yaya Cohen, the surgeon, when he hears about our experience in Fujigo, says, my word, he says, you were so much better off in Siam Road than you were in Fujigo, which is true. I mean, the greatest handicap was malaria. It was terrible, everybody getting malaria. I said only one person escaped, and I got that information from my father-in-law's book, and it was one brother, Roman Catholic brother, only who claimed not to have had malaria. Otherwise, it is pretty well 100% who are stricken with it. And it's not funny. And that was the biggest killer. And, something that should sap your energy, sap your morale. You know, you'd think to yourself, will we ever make it? When you got sick and you got fever. And you know, to see your little baby also shaking with malaria, that is heart-rending. I mean, you'd like to yourself to be sick 100 times to seeing the baby suffer and go through that malaria once. However, yeah, thank goodness he survived.
And could you get any news about your parents when they were taken away?
Not at all.
Until surrender?
Yes. I thought, actually, when they left, that was the last time I would see them, ever. But, they went from a bad place to a place which was much better.
And could you have any form of communication with outside?
Yes, we could exchange letters to Singapore and other parts of Malaya, but certainly if anybody attempted to send mail via the Red Cross overseas, if attempts were indeed made, I doubt very much whether those letters went very far. There were no such things as receiving Red Cross parcels, as far as we are concerned. We never received any.
You mentioned that the barber was chief personnel of the MPAJA.
One of the chief.
Yes, one of the chief. And had you noticed any kind of activities going on in Bahau? Things like asking for food or donation?
No, not at all. Nothing of that nature took place. Some of the difficulties and hazards that we encountered. Would you like to me to touch on that? Difficulties, of course, there were many. And I think I have probably spoken a lot about the difficulties. If anything crosses my mind, I shall talk about those. But hazards, wild animals, they were around, there's no doubt. We could hear them. We could hear the elephants trumpeting in the jungle. And in fact, many a time they would come and maraud our lots. I would grow sugar cane, and they would come along and swipe all my sugar cane. And they would come in big herds, and they would even trample and destroy, or partly destroy, huts. And I think if you look, and I'm sure Professor Edmund Tay must have related his experience with the elephants. When he and his friend suddenly woke up to find an elephant's tusk waving in front of him. What we would do is that as we heard them and saw them coming, we would go out with kerosene tins and bang them and try to frighten them away. We did have log fires going. As we cleared, we had big piles of wood burning, and they would make big, huge log fires. That would also deter the wild animals from coming nearby. But after a while, the Japanese forbade that, because B-27s were flying over. And so when in Singapore, there was what they call a brownout all the time, blackout, and they had a cover, the curtain, the lampshades and so on. So they didn't allow us to burn log fires, make log fires after a certain time. And one night, we heard our dogs sort of half barking. And the next morning, we found tigers' pug marks all around our chicken run. They were after our chickens. A good thing the dogs were locked inside the hut, couldn't come out, go out. Otherwise, they would have been killed by the tiger. We found tigers' pugs. But the tiger didn't attempt to break into the wire netting to get at the chickens, and just walked off. There were one or two people who spotted black panthers looking at them as they were walking through the park. But these wild animals don't attack, you know, unless they're provoked. Snakes, yes, but again, no known cases of snake bites. Centipedes. Scorpions, plenty of those. And I cannot forget the time when I was walking across the trunk of a tree which served as the bridge along the path to my house. And for some reason I was wearing long trousers. Why, I don't know, because we were usually wearing shorts. I felt this thing crawl up my legs, underneath my trousers. Hundreds of little feet, and I knew it was a centipede. I knew it was a centipede, and I knew also instinctively I couldn't squash it. It would sting me. So I did a dance. I just jumped up and down, and before it could get anywhere near my genitals or anywhere else, it slipped down. And oh boy, and I stamped on it and killed it. That was a lucky escape. Then whilst we were toiling, whilst we were chunk-hauling, suddenly I would look back and there would be a scorpion with his claws, you know, about to strike. And then I would swipe. And yes, and then there was a time when I was tending to my a little patch which I tried to grow groundnuts. And I suddenly heard a rustle, and when I went to see where this noise came from, there was a wild boar. My first instinct was to take all of my chunkle and try and kill it and catch to eat it, you see. But it was a young fellow, but I mean, you know, luckily, but it escaped. But I could have been its father or somebody and come and caught me. And there's another time when, I tell you, when I think of these things, it makes my heart go so soft. I had another rustle, and my little boy came running up to me, you know. You have a feeling of love when you see this sort of thing, and you're in a situation like that, and it's closely followed by the armor. He wanted to see his dad, you see. Of course, that wasn't a hazard, and it was a hazard for him, of course, if there was anything around. Again, of course, I told you about setting the traps in the jungles. That was a pretty hazardous thing to do because there were lots of wild animals around. And then these walking along the paths, as I mentioned, especially after dark, very eerie. And my walks to Mukim 5 to give dental treatment, very hazardous, very eerie. Pleasant experiences?
Yes.
One of the most pleasant experiences was seeing a British liberator fly ever so low over us to the point that we could see the people, we could see the pilot, we could see the people inside. And we waved to them and they waved back at them. They had just dropped paratroopers, Force 136, around us. They knew that we were there. They knew who we were. And they, you know, and this is near the end. And of course, I will talk about the most, you know, the after the war, when the surrender, we heard about the surrender. That can we keep for another time?
Yes, sure.
Is in the meanwhile, is there anything that I could tell you more about or you want to hear about Bahau?
The new batches came after your batch.
Yes.
Did they follow the same patterns more or less?
Yes. Generally, they follow the same. But we had to vacate the communal huts to give way to the new batches. One or two of them, like my father-in-law, had had his hut built before he went. But I was there to help, you see, and he had a brother-in-law there too who was helping him. But his arrival in Bahau was further delayed, was delayed by his illness. But each batch, as they came in, went through the same procedure. In the communal huts, draw a lot and find the way to their lots.
And outside the main entrance of the settlement, was there a big sign written on it?
Mm.
What was the...
It is Roman Catholic Bahau Settlement. I think you will find it in my father-in-law's book. Of Fujigo, there was a sign indicating that there was, this was a settlement.
And Dr. Oles? How did you know about the surrender?
Well,
Yes?
Well, my wife had difficulty in breastfeeding the newborn baby, and we thought that it would be necessary for us to get some powdered milk from the black market in Bahau town. So I cycled to Bahau town with Dr. Jaswant Singh Sodhi, and as usual, we had to report at the police station when we arrived at Bahau. There, Santokh Singh, the police officer in charge, broke the news to us. He told us that the Japanese had surrendered because they had a few very dreadful bombs dropped in Japan. We didn't know any details. We didn't know what atomic bombs were. He didn't even mention the bombs, but they were something catastrophic, and we didn't know how to take it. But for the fact that Santokh Singh and Dr. Jaswant Singh were good friends, I would have thought that this might have been a bit of a trick or something that was trying to catch us, you know, in some way or other. But we were assured that the news was authentic, and of course, once we heard that, when we were satisfied that this is true, that the Japanese had indeed surrendered, that the war was over, we cycled back to the colony as fast as we could. Nobody in the colony had heard anything about this. As we drove, cycled